This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib coming up on Africa News Tonight.
He has to revoke that decision because it's not fair. No, it's not fair. And all Congolese have the right to vote.
In the DRC, that is opposition candidate Martin Fayulu talking about the delay in voting in some areas. Details coming up.
Also, there is now a program targeted for Africa that's designed to help develop crops that are resistant to climate change. And former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak this week testified against his successor, Mohamed Morsi, in court.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The president of the DRC tells VOA he sees no reason why national elections cannot proceed on Sunday, saying the Electoral Commission is ready and has security in place. In an exclusive interview with reporter Salome Wanamalonga last night, President Joseph Kabila said the only reason the vote was delayed from last Sunday was that a fire earlier this month had destroyed some election materials. However, he defended the decision to postpone voting in eastern DRC until March because of the Ebola outbreak there.
Jibu la seni ni kwamba uchaguzi umeahirishwa hadi hapo.
Kabila says that the voting machines use computer touch screens, and that means everyone will touch the screens, so it is going to be easy to spread the virus. Voting was postponed in other areas for security concerns. The elections already have been delayed for 2 years. Kabila is constitutionally barred from running again, but he handpicked his party's candidate, Emmanuel Ramazani Sidari, and Kabila, who has been in office since 2001, has not ruled out running for office again.
Meanwhile, the DRC opposition says the decision to postpone voting in the East is meant to undermine their support. Opposition candidate Martin Fayulu today gave an exclusive interview to VOA's Peter Cloete and said candidates faced no danger in campaigning in the Eastern Congo.
The situation for us is going very well. We have put in place 220,000 witnesses in each poll station. And the only issue we are having that Mr. Nanga, the president of Steny, has revoked some polling station and also some areas that he said that the election will not take place, which is totally unbelievable for us.
Well, so what are you going to do about this? Because a lot of people are unhappy, and some would say that it would even undermine the integrity of the election.
Yeah, but he is undermining the integrity of the elections. But we told him to refrain himself to that decision. He has to revoke that decision because it's not fair. You know, it's not fair, and all Congolese have the right to vote. And all those areas, we went there, we campaigned, and everything went well. But how can he come today and say that we cannot have election in this area? We think that he's punishing people of Beni, Butembo, because they have changed their mind, they want to change, they want to vote for Martin Fayulu, and that's why they want to undermine my score. That's not acceptable at all.
When you spoke with the CNE and Nanga, did he agree to change his mind to ensure that voting is held in these areas, mostly opposition strongholds?
We wrote to him, and we told him that we needed to have a discussion with him to see what is going on, why he's taking all those decisions which are, not in his areas. He cannot take those decisions because he cannot postpone the election. He cannot revoke elections somewhere. All those decisions should be taken by the Constitutional Court. But Mr. Nanga, without consulting anybody, is not going further and trying to disturb the people of Congo.
That was DRC opposition candidate Martin Fayulu speaking with our colleague Peter Cloti today. For more of that exclusive interview, please tune in VOA Africa Nightline program tomorrow at 1600 UTC with host Peter Cloti.
With 2 days to go, it appears that the long-delayed election will actually take place on Sunday despite more bumps in the road. A late opposition call for a nationwide strike went largely unheeded today, with some people saying they didn't hear about it in time. A new poll gave opposition candidate Martin Fayulu a strong lead, with President Joseph Kabila's hand-picked candidate running third. There will be longer lines to vote in Kinshasa because some replacement voting machines didn't arrive in time after a fire destroyed most of the ones that were being stored in the capital. And more protests were reported in opposition strongholds in the east, where the government has delayed voting until March because of an Ebola outbreak. The international aid agency Oxfam has suspended operations in Beni and Butembo, and Doctors Without Borders pulled staff out yesterday due to security concerns before allowing them to return. VOA reporter Abdurrahmani Dia is in Kinshasa, and he spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander.
One of the opposition candidates had called for a day of strike, what they call a death city, asking people to stay home. But here in Kinshasa, it was not very successful. Traffic was still heavy in some areas. Shops were open. We have been told that the city of Beni and also in Goma, in the eastern part of the country, there have been protests. The Electoral Commission has announced that they have canceled more than 1,000 polling stations for Kinshasa. It's roughly about 14% of the station, the polling stations for the city, saying that they still were not able to recover all of the machine, the voting machine that they were expecting. And the result of this is that instead of having 600 voters per machine, they will now have 700 voters per machine, which obviously would mean longer lines.
What are the concerns about violence related to the election, especially with a new poll showing the main opposition candidate, Fayulu, with a strong lead and Kabila's hand-picked successor running third?
There is always a risk for violence when it comes to elections in the DRC and probably other countries in Africa as well. But specifically here, people are on edge because many of them, at least in the opposition, don't trust the electoral body to conduct a free and fair election. And when there is no trust, there is always a risk for violence or not accepting the results.
Anything further from Beni?
There is really a risk of propagation even more for Ebola because the protesters did attack one of the transit centers. And about 20 suspected, or at least to some people that were supposed to be checked for Ebola, some of them had escaped. So they don't know how many of those really had the virus on them. So that is really a health issue. And today we are told there were some more protests there. So it's probably more volatile than here in Kinshasa for now. In Kinshasa, people, I think, are just waiting come Sunday before really expressing how they feel on the outside. There's room for surprises always.
That was VOA journalist Abdurrahmani Dia in Kinshasa speaking with my colleague Paul Alexander.
Reports say a tourist bus has been hit by an explosion near Egypt's pyramids. Details were still coming in, but officials said two of the 14 tourists on the bus were killed and 10 were injured, including the driver. The bomb was described as a primitive device that went off in the Al-Haram area. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but speculation focused on a terrorist attack in response for Egypt's crackdown on Islamist extremists.
A new program aims to improve food and nutrition security as well as the incomes of smallholder and livestock farmers in Senegal through a partnership with the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD. The partnership will promote climate-resilient agriculture and rural entrepreneurship in over 43,700 rural households in four regions of Senegal, where the agriculture sector is extremely vulnerable to climate change. The program also focuses on helping women and young people become business owners. I spoke with Benoit Terry, IFAD's West Africa Hub Director in Dakar.
This program is centered on the east of Senegal, going from the Senegal River in the very dry area, Matam, Tambacounda, and then southern area, which is more rainy, which is Kolda and Kédougou. So the activities are varying a lot according to the type of climate. And the livestock activity are mostly in the north, where we address it through new boreholes and also some fodder cultivation for the animals.
What types of crops will be made climate resistant?
Oh, on climate adaptation, there are many activities. Some are done through specific system with irrigation. When we do these boreholes, we always have a part where we can do 10, 20 hectares for irrigation. This is in the fallow area, which is very dry. Along the river in Senegal, we can do bigger irrigation scheme of 500 hectares with many, many farmers doing rice. But let's say climate adaptation is mostly on dry lands, so it's more in the center and south where we use traditional varieties but with new agronomic practices, which helps to benefit better of the rain when it arrives. You know, mostly the main problem is you cannot predict when the rainy season starts now. The first or second or third rain can be not enough to grow a good crop, so you have to sow and sow again to get it right and produce enough.
I understand the aim of the program is also to ensure that at least 50% of the participants are women and 50% are young people. Why is it so important to include women and young people in this program in Senegal?
For years, we're having activities with women because they are a key element in the economic life of families. And women activities were starting a lot from cultivation. We started first with group of women so they can learn together new techniques. And once the group has learned it, they can apply it on their family land in their own farm and use it for the family, which is very helpful. And a big element is that they learn so many new crops, especially in vegetables production, that this has completely transformed the way they feed the family and they cook also. So we are doing a lot of cooking activities. And this is superb in terms of results because now you can go to families where the diet is very diversified. It's not only cereals like in the past, but they use a lot of vegetables. This was really amazing. Some of them, of these women, have opened restaurants now where they also cook for big groups with these many new crops they have learned. About the young people, everywhere I noticed that the many countries I've been working through with IFAD is that we are called by government to work with young people. This is mostly because you have huge cohort of youth coming to the market, the employment market every year. IFAD is working in 100 countries and in each of them you have 200,000, half million young people coming to the market. In Senegal, it's 200,000 young people coming every year. And this is quite difficult for these governments to find employment for everybody. So with the youth, we are focusing mostly on economic activities. It's either to learn about modern agriculture or how to launch a rural enterprise. It goes from agriculture to all the rural enterprise you can imagine.
And when is this program going to be implemented?
We are first completing the phase one of the program, which was a bit more traditional, and this one will close in the next 4 or 5 months. So the objective is to start this new one by May or June 2019. So we have a few months before we can run the two programs together. Phase two can learn from phase one to have a smooth handover and a good start of this new phase.
That was Benoit Terry, EFAD's West Africa Hub Director. He spoke with me from Dakar.
20 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak this week testified against his successor, Mohamed Morsi, in court. He said that about 800 armed men crossed the border from Gaza in 2011 and stormed prisons to release Hamas and Muslim Brotherhood prisoners, including Morsi. Mubarak also said that some of the men who crossed the border shot at demonstrators during the Arab Spring protests in Tahrir Square in 2011. Activists maintained that Egyptian soldiers were the ones who fired on them. The protests eventually forced Mubarak from office. Morsi was elected president, but he was later ousted in a military coup. Sahara Aziz is a professor of law and director of Center for Security, Race and Rights at Rutgers University. She spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about Mubarak's testimony and how the trial is perceived.
Well, it depends on whether his testimony is credible, and there are two problems. First is that according to news reports, Mubarak says that Omar Suleiman told him this information, as opposed to him having direct knowledge. And Omar Suleiman, as we know, is dead. So we do not have the person who might have the most direct knowledge in terms of access to the intelligence available to testify. The second is that Mubarak is not a credible witness because he doesn't have good faith motives. This is the same president that was ousted forcibly by mass revolt by the Egyptian people, and now it appears that he's seeking to retaliate or seeking revenge against the president who then proceeded to win the presidency through democratic elections. So he has a major credibility problem.
Mubarak stated that the armed men who infiltrated borders fired their weapons against demonstrators in Tahrir Square, while activists maintained that Egyptian security forces were the ones that were shooting them from buildings' roofs in Tahrir Square. What do you make of that?
It's very difficult to know the truth because, on the one hand, there was plenty of evidence at the time that the Egyptian security forces were attacking the protesters. It was a very violent period during the mass uprisings, but there was also shooting going on from various sides. Whether or not there were people that were foreigners that had come from a different country to fight, we didn't have any evidence of that at the time. Those weren't the news reports. The reports were primarily that both sides were shooting, but the security forces were being the most aggressive, and that there was certainly reports at the time that there had been a prison break within Egypt, and there had been people who had escaped from prison, some of whom were violent criminals, some of whom were political prisoners. But again, this is separate from this wild conspiracy that people came from outside of Egypt and fight in this revolution that was clearly started and supported by the Egyptian people at the time.
From a legal point of view, what is the basis for putting former President Mohamed Morsi on trial for charges dating back to 2011 if he was legally allowed to run for presidency in 2012?
If he had, in fact, or if there was strong evidence to show that Morsi had violated the law by releasing the prisoners or by engaging in other criminal activity, he would have been deemed ineligible to run for the presidency. And we remember that a number of candidates had, in fact, been disqualified from running, some of whom, like Khaled al-Shater, because he had been convicted prior under Mubarak for other charges, and there was Abu Ismail, something about his mother having dual citizenship, and many other candidates had been disqualified. So it's disingenuous and discreditable for these charges to be brought now after Morsi was forcibly ousted by a coup that may have been partially supported, by Egyptians at the time in 2013, but notwithstanding the fact that ultimately it was a military general that replaced him. So it's incredulous for many people in Egypt and outside Egypt to take this trial seriously as a criminal trial as opposed to see it as a political trial.
That was Sara Aziz, professor of law and director of Center for Security, Race and Rights at Rutgers University. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
New York City boasts nearly 27,000 restaurants, from fast food to the fanciest of hot cuisine. One of them showcases the diverse foods of Africa and the African diaspora in unique and unexpected ways. VOA's Adam Phillips got a tasty tour by its founder and chef.
It's dinner hour at the Henry the Life Hotel by JJ Restaurant. And Joseph Johnson, its chef and guiding light, surveys the sea of diners and smiles wide.
You're proud of this place, huh?
Yeah, I'm proud. 100% I'm proud.
Johnson honed his skills at a prestigious culinary school, but his grandmother's cooking and his brief stint as a chef in Ghana set the stage for this critically acclaimed eatery.
My grandmother's Puerto Rican. A lot of the spices, coriander, cumin, pink peppercorns, turmeric, were found in her cabinet. And those were a lot of the things that I was cooking with in Ghana. And a lot of the kitchen smelled like my grandmother's kitchen smelled like when I was a kid. And that's when I started to realize that I was from this food, and I wanted to start cooking the food of who I am and telling the world about it. Fast forward 6 years, I'm here now, and I'm expressing what I consider the Pan-African food that really represents me.
Indeed, many of the recipes are rooted in diverse cultures, ranging from Morocco in the north to South Africa in the south.
I would say the common denominator in all that food is jollof, you know, this very tomato, spicy rice that those areas of the world argue over of who cooks it better. But everything here is my interpretation of the food. So let's say the jollof, typically it would be red fluffy rice based on the ingredients, the mirepoix, bird's eye chili, onions, ginger, garlic. And here at the Henry, I do a jollof style curry that goes on top of rice. And I'm connecting West Africa with the Dominican Republic, and I'm doing concon, which means the bottom of the pot. The key is to get it to taste familiar and be delicious.
One recipe uses an heirloom sesame seed brought to America by enslaved West Africans. Johnson adds it to tuna tartare for an Afro-Japanese touch. Diners can also enjoy African-American soul foods, such as yams, black-eyed peas, and okra, all of which are familiar to many current-day Africans.
How many salmon do you have to start, Derek?
The dinner crowd is hitting its peak, but back in the kitchen, all is smoothly efficient. Johnson nods to line cook Mamadou Bamba, a famous chef back in his native Ivory Coast.
Yeah, I'm chopping right now on a basil for my Afropot dishes, which I'm going to do right now. This is kind of like bring a little bit of flavor on it.
Smells good.
Yeah, smells very good. Basil. I like that.
Do you have
like
that basil back home?
Not really, because we always make it sauce. We call like a jumbo. I don't know if you know jumbo. That's what we use for our flavor back home. Yeah.
It's like a concentrate of spices that they use to build the flavor. I make my own jumbo.
Nearby, Melita Jones, a Jamaican-American, puts the finishing touches on some oxtail egg rolls.
Edamame, cabbage, a little bit of oxtails. So you get the kind of American aspect with the Caribbean aspect.
All this cross-pollination is a joy to waitress Tiana Anderson, an African-American from a Bronx, New York neighborhood where thousands of West Africans, Afro-Latinos, and Afro-Caribbeans live. A big part of Tiana's job is sharing these hybrid flavors.
That makes it fun. That is what food culture is. That is what New York City is. Just like opening up a lot of people's minds. So many different experiences and so many different cultures. When you come to this city, you can be a purist, but it's about exploring those places that incorporate those different flavors, which will open you up to the other cultures in the world.
Indeed, in the city that never sleeps but always eats, both grandma and the most discerning African can feel proud, satisfied, and right at home in this restaurant. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.